From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Tim Mack, senior correspondent for the Daily Beast, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. And here are the issues. Real estate tycoon Donald Trump lost in the first actual voting contest for the Republican presidential nomination in Iowa to Senator Ted Cruz, a conservative. And former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton narrowly defeated Senator Bernie Sanders in the Iowa caucuses in their battle for the Democratic presidential nomination. In Geneva, talks seeking a peace settlement in Syria fell apart. And refugees from the Middle East and North Africa continued to flood into Europe as no plan to stop them has been agreed on by European leaders. And in Baltimore, President Obama visited a mosque for the first time and said Muslims are welcome in America. You fit in here, he told them. You are part of America. Well, two great presidential races. If you write about politics, as I do, it's fun to have two great presidential races going on here. Let's start with the Republicans. You know, there was so many interesting things in Iowa. Donald Trump, who was leading in the polls, came in second, Michael, to Ted Cruz. And the evening of the caucuses, of course, oh, he was so gracious in congratulating his opponents, including Senator Cruz, who beat him. But the next morning, he sort of returned to form and was saying he'd been cheated and so on. Now we're going to have the New Hampshire primary. Donald Trump is way ahead in polls there. And how do you say I believe the race is shaking out on the Republican side? We'll get to the Democrats in a few minutes.
Well, on the Republican side, we'd start with Iowa. You know, say that the story really is Trump losing almost as much as it is, or more so, than Cruz winning. Mm-hmm. And people are pointing back to why this happened when it seemed as though Trump was going to win this thing. And, you know, is it the fact that he skipped the debate right mm-hmm. before that caucus? And that's sort of a, as the lawyers say, post hoc ergo propter. Yeah. You know, when they say after that, therefore because of that. And that ain't necessarily so. I would mm-hmm. more attribute it to his lack of ground mm-hmm. game and him having his daughter teaching people how to caucus, mm-hmm. you know, in a state where mm-hmm. that demands a mm-hmm. professional organization on the ground. But Donald Trump lost the most by not winning, I think, because the bubble of Trump inevitability mm-hmm. has been pierced. Mm-hmm. And if he had won, it would have signaled maybe a brand new mm-hmm. way of doing things in politics, that celebrity actually can out, especially in a place where politics is premier, such as Iowa, but a consummate politician won. So now it's a little bit more back to business and usual, and Trump is going to have mm-hmm. to get back on the ground and do it just like everybody else, have a professional organization, beat on doors, and win things. It's not just bombast that's mm-hmm. going to win this thing.
I like bombast, but I wouldn't recommend it. I agree with Michael. What about Republicans, Tim?
Yeah, I think Michael makes a really good point about what ground game mm-hmm. being what really matters. And the fact that stood out to me was that he spent more money on hats than on voter contacts. He spent more money on those red Make America Great hats than mm-hmm. on building an organization that could reach out to voters and get them out on Election Day.
Mm-hmm.
But however, despite the fact that he came in second in Iowa, Iowa was never a state that should have been all that favorable towards Donald mm-hmm. Trump. His strength is amongst more moderate Republicans, mm-hmm. not evangelical Republicans, and not the most conservative Republicans. Mm-hmm. And what you see and what you're going to see in New Hampshire is that it's much more of a state for him to dominate. And then you look at the next contest. Oh, well, it's South Carolina. That's the of the three early states, that's the state he's always been strongest in.
Yeah.
So this is by no means a defeat of Donald Trump. And I think we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves by presuming that the inevitability or the invisibility is, although stripped, it doesn't have a part to play in mm-hmm. the future. I think he still has a very strong chance of winning the nomination.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, look, we're in journalism. We always get ahead of ourselves. That's what, you know, we always like to talk about the future rather than the past. One more question about the Republicans. Is Donald Trump really the Republican front runner still? Michael?
I would say that he's the front runner, again, in terms of attentions. He is leading.
Well, I was asking, and what about in terms of getting the nomination?
In terms of getting the nomination, I would say that it's almost like a three-horse race right now, and we're looking to see who's going to be that fourth horse. So now mm-hmm. we certainly have Trump, we certainly have Cruz, and Rubio has made himself mm-hmm. sort of a darling right now.
Right, that's Marco Rubio, the Marco senator Rubio. From Florida.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And if John Kasich, the former governor of Ohio, can do well, if he can somehow finish third in this New Hampshire primary. I think he makes himself a very practical and pragmatic choice for those centrist Republicans you were talking about before. But I'd say it's Trump-Cruz in a neck-and-neck race right now.
Damn. Yeah, in terms of front-runner, I mean, if it wasn't Donald Trump we were talking about, right, this man has led in the national polls for 6 months.
Yeah.
He leads in New Hampshire the next state, and he leads in South Carolina.
He leads everywhere, practically.
He leads everywhere else.
In polls.
In polls. And, of course, primaries are easier to organize for than caucuses.
Mm-hmm.
And so he might have some advantage there. I think undoubtedly he remains the front runner. I mean,
okay.
But the thing is that his brand is so caught up, and we talked about this earlier, it's so caught up in this idea of winning. I'm a winner. I'm gonna if I'm president, I'm going to win so much you're going to be tired of winning. You're going to ask for a loss once now and again.
Well, now he says he'd actually won in Iowa if Cruz hadn't cheated.
Well, there is an argument to be made about some dirty tricks being played in Iowa.
Yeah.
There is an argument to be made that, what happened was that on the day of the caucuses, Ben Carson, one of the other Republican candidates, said that he would be returning to Florida after the Iowa caucuses, which some people interpreted to mean that he'd be dropping out of the race.
Yeah.
And Ted Cruz's campaign very quickly sent out messages and emails, phone calls to people throughout Iowa saying, look, you got to inform Ben Carson voters that their guy is going to be out.
Yeah.
Of course, Ben Carson turned out not to drop out. He lost probably not an insubstantial amount of support that night, probably from some of
he
these
He just went home for a couple days. Anyway, okay, I don't consider that to be that bad a dirty trick, but it was a little tricky.
Well, you know, as we say in sports, you are what your record says you are.
Sure.
You know,
okay. Okay. Let's go to Democrats. And there, it looked in the beginning like that was going to be a very friendly race between Bernie Sanders, the senator of Vermont, the self-professed Democratic socialist, and Hillary Clinton, of course, the former Secretary of State, First Lady when her husband Bill Clinton was president, and so on. And now it's gotten pretty nasty. They basically tied in Iowa, and now there's some questions there about whether the caucuses in Iowa, about the numbers and flipping a coin to see who wins delegate slates in different places. And the Des Moines Register, a really sort of a good government paper. I mean, it has said they've really got to release a lot of the raw totals and everything, all the numbers, and a state chairwoman in Iowa doesn't want to do that. She's a big supporter of Hillary Clinton. Anyway, what about Iowa for Democrats? Or what about Democrats in general, Hillary and Sanders?
Well, you know, if things get close and there's going to be a fight, it's going to be a nasty, dirty fight because it's the only way the Clintons know how to do it. I mean, there's not going to be civil if it's going to be an argument. I mean, it was so typical Clinton to come out and declare, before it was a clear winner, for Hillary to take the stage and declare herself as a winner. If she ever has to wonder about that likability thing, it's things like that,
yeah,
you know, that affect that sort of thing. So note to self, don't do that. Mm-hmm. I think the most fascinating part about the Democratic side is how Bernie Sanders has taken this party to the left.
Mm-hmm.
There is a part of the Tea Party when it first came into existence that was Democrat also, that wanted to have a breakup of big government,
yeah,
no bailouts for companies, and a lot of different changes. And he's taken somehow that part of the electorate and made them his own and somehow multiplied them. It's just really fun to watch Bernie be himself and taking these pieces of one-issue campaigns that have happened over the course of the last 20 years and stitched them into this suit of armor that is serving him so well against a presumptive nominee. It's a great campaign.
Tim, it's not fun for Hillary. She seems to think that he is smearing her because he keeps bringing up all the money, the beach fees she's gotten on Wall Street. You know, I don't know how many speeches you've been paid $200,000 for, but I'm still looking for my first one. and that's a smear when he brings that up. And their race has gotten pretty angry. They're pretty angry at each other. He's a socialist and she's not.
I think it's gotten a little heated in the debates, but it's actually been a very genuine debate about the issues in the Democratic primary, right? That Bernie has refused to bring up, for example, Hillary Clinton's email scandal, which is a legitimate scandal. He doesn't want to get caught up in that. He wants to talk more about the state of the middle class or where wealth is distributed in the country. And so I think that it's not really fair to characterize the Democratic primary as angry. And Hillary Clinton doesn't have a leg to stand on when she
says, though that's the way I characterized it. Yes.
I don't think Hillary Clinton has a leg to stand on when she says that she's being unfairly smeared. Bernie's just bringing up her record.
Okay, let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on the Voice of America. hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes with Michael Williams and Tim Mack. There's one amazing poll number, I think, coming out of Iowa, and that is it was in what they called an entrance poll. Usually they do exit polls, but this people going into the Democratic caucuses, it said 84% of young people, that is between 17 and 29, were for Sanders and only 14% for Hillary. I mean, that's incredible, young people, the way they're backing Sanders. How do you explain that, Michael?
It's simply the things that he's saying. I mean, he's appealing to a generation that has realized that the issues of the day and the way the status quo is not going to serve them very well at all. And so he's giving a laundry list, or a Christmas list, if you want to characterize it that way, of things that would certainly make things better for that particular generation. Can he deliver on those things? Remains to be seen. Does he have the coattails to get the majority in both houses that Obama had when he came into office to make some of his things happen, like the Affordable Care Act? Remains to be seen. But he's speaking to them in a very clear way. And it fascinates me that he got this thing. And it fascinates me also that Hillary hasn't been able to hit on either one of the two constituencies that she needs to appeal to, which is women and African Americans. Mm-hmm. Still out there, still undecided.
Well, we'll see about African Americans, particularly when we get to South Carolina. But what about Hillary says that the Sanders, all the stuff he says, that Michael outlined some of, it's just pie in the sky. He can't get that. That she wants to go for things, liberal programs that are achievable.
Right. Well, I think Michael says it remains to be seen. I'd go a little bit further. I'd say Bernie Sanders proposes a lot of things that just will never happen. I mean, he is one of the most progressive individuals in the House or Senate during his times there. The House of Representatives is very, very, very unlikely to flip in this election, given gerrymandering. He is going to face a very hostile Congress if he ever makes it to the White House. And he's going to end up doing a lot of executive action around the edges, not quite the transformational programs that he'd want to push forward.
I like him because he's the only candidate in either party who's older than I am. But here's my question, Michael. Again, front runner. Most people believe, and I do, that if you had to bet, you'd bet on Hillary winning the nomination.
I would do the same. I mean, with the organization that she has, the support that she has, the money that she has, I think she still is the clear front runner. But again, running against a candidate, I never thought I'd see a candidate successfully run a campaign like this who's running essentially to the left of Dennis Kucinich in 2008. Right. I mean, that's astonishing. I don't even know that there's room for a person between
Dennis Kucinich, for those who may not remember him, I think the three of us do, but was the mayor of Cleveland, and then he was a House member, and he was decidedly left-wing, I would say.
And the thing about Bernie Sanders is that he lacks all the natural charisma that you would find in a Barack Obama, right? For example, right? Mm-hmm. And he's motivating the same age group of people, very young people, and he's doing it in a very cranky kind of way.
Yeah. He seems to irritate Hillary by being so likable.
And maybe that's what's so appealing about him.
Yeah, that she has a likability problem. Well, we'll talk about that later. Okay. The Syrian peace talks. I don't think anybody, at least they shouldn't have had even a faint breeze of optimism about these talks getting anywhere. And they haven't, Michael.
No, they haven't. I mean, when you spell peace talks, I think you'd be better served to spell it P-I-E-C-E. Because, you know, we're talking about a little piece of this, a little piece of that. Mm-hmm. They could not be peace talks. You don't have all of the combatants there at the table. You don't have ISIS. So how can you have peace talks? They were really talking about what to talk about. Mm-hmm. And the fighting is still so fierce. It's still so fractionalized there. Mm-hmm. There's no way that these could have been successful. There's no way. And I think it's just hopeful that they don't make things worse, that no one came to the table and said anything that's going to make anything work. You had this friction going on between Russia and Turkey about airspace and that sort of thing. So now you have people who should be partners actually having issues with each other. So it was not a disaster, but it was just not effective at all.
Tim?
Well, the peace talks, I think, were a catastrophe. It's a catastrophe for the Syrian people, of which there are millions currently trying to flee the country to avoid violence. For the families of the 250,000 people who have died in the conflict, you know, it depends on how you view the goals of peace talks, right? Originally, what these peace talks were meant to do was to create a political transition, perhaps so that we could remove Bashar al-Assad from power and replace him with some sort of agreed-upon government. That was the original big goal.
That wasn't the Russian goal or the Iranian goal or Assad's goal.
Some sort of political process that stopped the violence, right? But that proved to be very quickly unachievable. So they kind of reduced the goals and they said, hey, well, can we at least have a pause in fighting so we can get some humanitarian aid into some of these besieged cities, which, of course, the Assad regime doesn't want. Its entire strategy is to take opposition strongholds and say either you're going to starve to death or you will get on your knees and succumb to the authority of the regime. So the Assad regime has no interest in allowing for a humanitarian pause. It seemed like there was more conversations about where people would sit in different rooms or whether they would face each other during conversations or whether they would be in separate places and send emissaries than actually discussing the fate of millions of people who are in desperate, desperate straits.
Right. Well, on that incredible note of pessimism, which I think we all agree with, it's time for another break. And we'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis. And on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes with Tim Mack and Michael Williams. We're going to talk briefly about the refugees pouring into Europe from the Middle East, from far away as Afghanistan, and from North Africa. It seems to be the flow is not getting smaller, seems to be getting bigger. I think the numbers I saw, Michael, showed that there were more, at least in January of 2016, coming into Europe, the refugees, as well as they count them, than there were coming in January 2015.
Right.
The European government seemed to be paralyzed about this.
How can they
about
not
what to do?
Be? I mean, how can they not be? I mean, with the flow
I can think of lots of ways, but anyway, go ahead.
Well, let's say this. Paralyzed in the sense of what exactly to do when you have so many partners who have so many different things. It's kind of like the peace talks. You have people who do not have the same agenda sitting down at the table trying to discuss what to do. You have 67,000 refugees who came in a single month.
But the whole idea of the European Union is we can all come together and decide on these things together. Isn't that what the European Union is supposed to be about?
I mean, that's what the name is. And yeah. I think that, you know, prior to this, I think the European Union has been very effective in that, given, again, a disparate set of priorities. But I have characterized this before, that this is the one issue, maybe, this refugee issue, that could really split that thing apart because it has levers in so many different places, financially, culturally, in so many different parts of what the European Union is supposed to be. Look, they're pledging money now, but they're pledging a lot more support, a lot more humanitarian aid. Still, you have, of the million refugees who have come since 2015, I believe the New York Times reported that 190 have been permanently placed. 190. I mean, there is...
Are you suggesting they're off to a slow start?
I would say that it's rather deliberate. You know, if anything, that's a very generous assessment. Yeah. Like it's a very, very difficult problem, and it just keeps getting worse every day.
Okay, Tim?
Well, you know, the refugee problem won't stop until they solve the source of the refugee problem, right? As long as people continue to die, if you and I were in a place where our families were constantly being bombarded by barrel bombs flying in from the sky at random, and people all around you are dying and there's no food, you would leave the place you're at. And millions of people are choosing to do that. And there's this swath of humanity out there that is desperate, and they're desperate in need of an end to the violence. And until Europe wants to get involved more dramatically in ending the violence, whether it's by taking action to create a no-fly zone or a humanitarian zone in northern Syria or in some other political process, and until they're really committed to ending the violence in Syria and they want to act, this is going to continue to happen. You're not going to be able to build enough fences around Europe to be able to stop people from coming because these people are fighting for their lives.
Okay. Hard to argue with that. I certainly agree. Anyway, President Obama visited a mosque in Baltimore. Remember, after 9/11, President Bush visited a mosque in Washington. Well, anyway, here is President Obama, and here are a couple things he said. He was speaking to the Muslims who attend that mosque. He said, today there are voices in this world, particularly over the internet, who are constantly claiming that you have to choose between your identities, as a Muslim, for example, or an American. Do not believe them, the president said. If you're ever wondering whether you fit in here, let me say it as clearly as I can. As president of the United States, you fit in here. You're part of America, too. You're not Muslim or American. You are Muslim and American. A pretty good speech, that was, and he reiterated this same theme the next day at the National Prayer Breakfast. Even the Wall Street Journal, which is usually critical of President Obama, really had an editorial supporting him on there, praising him on this, Michael.
I thought it was the best of President Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. This is where he is really at his best as a leader, as a compassionate leader, as a visionary. As a moral economist, on mm-hmm. the one hand, he understands this group of people. He understands and has compassion for the other point of view and wants to reconcile the two. It was a heartfelt speech, and it was speaking to two audiences, the Muslim American community, mm-hmm. certainly the one he was sitting in front of, but the Muslim American community across the country, but also to those who would have these xenophobic feelings about Muslims, who have a fear that has been inspired by terrorist acts. And he's speaking to them to calm their fears and to begin a process of understanding, calming any type of attack or retribution against people who really obviously do not deserve it. I think it was a great speech, and I applaud the Wall Street Journal for saying so.
Tim?
Yeah, I mean, in his last State of the Union, President Obama lamented that one of the things that he had not been able to do was to kind of bridge the partisan divide and kind of reduce some of the rancor in Washington and across the country. And this is one of the things that he's trying to do in order to address that. He understands that it's been a very difficult decade and a half for American Muslims, especially in this particular atmosphere. And we can point only to the Republican side at the moment. There's a lot of hostility against Muslims. I mean, Donald Trump wanted to ban all Muslims from entering the country.
Yeah, but most Republican leaders criticized him for that.
That's fine, but he's still the front runner of the Republican Party.
Well, okay,
and as we all agree, he's most likely of the candidates right now to win the nomination. He has a significant amount of the Republican primary audience behind him. Mm-hmm. So while not the dominant, or you could argue about whether it's the dominant view, it's still a very it's pervasive. Mm-hmm. It's a substantial percentage of Americans who mm-hmm. feel this way. And I think President Obama is just trying to push back against that. He mm-hmm. views that as one of his failures in office.
You know, one of the people who criticized Donald Trump for saying we shouldn't be letting any Muslims in now was the new Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, who visited the White House. He, along with the Republican leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, talked for a while to President Obama. Then I think it was only, I don't know how they pull this off, that it was only Ryan who stayed for lunch with the president. It's a little late for the president, after doing so many things on his own, the executive action that Republicans criticize for he should have gone to Congress about, but yet maybe there's some possibility here. Is there? What about something along that line? I mean, can he repair relations a little bit with Republicans so they can do some things together?
There's always that chance, but I think it's reduced by the fact that you're in the middle of an election cycle, a mm-hmm. presidential election campaign. No one wants to give anything to the Democrats to use as fuel on the campaign trail. And certainly that opposition to Mitch McConnell, as Mitch McConnell said 4 years ago, 5 years ago, mm-hmm. our number one job is to get President Obama out of office. That mission isn't going to change. Maybe you can nibble around the edges, but something substantive, I seriously doubt mm-hmm. it.
Tim?
I think he's really constrained by his conference, that the Republicans in the House chose him to try to push back against President Obama. I don't think that there's going to be a lot of cooperation done over this year. That Congress is only in a third of the days of the year. It's not going to be doing a lot of substantial work. I mean, just this past week, we saw the House vote again to try to repeal Obamacare. Mm-hmm. It's not working in a productive way. The House mm-hmm. of Representatives is not working in a productive way. That's what it's choosing to spend its limited time on.
Yeah, but, you know, there are things that the President and Congress have to do. You know, Michael, they have to deal with the budget and spend and issues like that. This is the president's last year in office, and he did run. People forget that he ran on what you were referring to earlier, Michael, I can bring people together, I can end the polarization in Washington. And he admits he's been unsuccessful. I think he doesn't blame himself much, but in other words, I agree. I think he would like to change the atmosphere pretty dramatically, and maybe he can a little bit.
He can change the atmosphere, but changing the actual practical politics of it, I agree. With Tim, how exactly do you do that when you have a mandate from the other side to not do that? You have to have a partner to shake hands mm-hmm. with, and currently just doesn't have a partner.
Well, you know, Republicans think they don't have a partner, and when you have that, that's called polarization.
And there we have Washington in a nutshell.
All right, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tim Mack, senior correspondent for The Daily Beast, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Jackson Witt and Linus Rimkus. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.